wildlife and its habitat cannot speak. So we must. And we will.
You're listening to the Conservation Federation of Missouri podcast. Here's Executive Director Brandon Butler.
Welcome to Conservation Federation Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Butler, and today I'm very excited to bring a friend of mine from Montana to Missouri, Mr. Hal Herring.
Thank you, Brandon. I'm glad to get here, man.
So Hal, if you don't know who he is, he's one of the leading conservation writers in America. He's for sure one of the most schooled up individuals on the public lands fight that we're in, really focusing on Western federal public lands. Originally an Alabama guy, he was back home for the holidays, and now he's on his way back to Montana. Thankfully stopped into Missouri for a couple nights, had him down at the cabin and showed him a bunch of the Missouri Ozarks. And now we're up here in good old Howard County, and we're going to talk conservation and federal public lands and really how we've had a great run of visitors on this podcast focusing on Missouri.
Okay.
So I want to step outside of our state for a little bit and get you talking about some of the issues we face as a nation. But first, give us a little background growing up an Alabama boy.
Well, for one thing, let me say, this is my first time really in the Ozarks, and I've seen stuff here that I just couldn't imagine, the vastness of it and the culture, hunting and fishing and just backwoodsman culture, my kind of place, man.
Yeah, it's a special place.
Stone cold, my kind of place.
And cold's the right word.
It is.
We braved about 0 degree nights with no heat down in the cabin, but I'm excited to bring you back in the summer and get you out on Current River. And you know, we were fortunate to go see Alley Spring and those smallmouth that are stacked up in there.
You bet. I'm a smallmouth freak.
So when we get back this summer, we'll get on the Jack's Fork and get you after some of those smallmouth.
Right on. So to give you some of where I come from, I guess, in that, I'm from North Alabama, although my parents both were from South Alabama, and they moved to North Alabama kind of take advantage of more economy, you know. My father was in World War II B-17 pilot, and when I was about 10, They were uncomfortable living in the suburbs of Huntsville, Alabama. They really were, and it just didn't work for them. And we all moved out to rural Madison County. That's really the best thing that ever happened to me. I was obsessed with snakes and fishing, and I had like a life list of snakes when we lived in town. I mean, at that time, it was still good country, real close at hand, and there still is. So we moved out in the country, and I just took up fishing and hunting pretty much as a full time gig. I read about it. I went every day after school. I skipped school. I was never a good student. I missed the bus on purpose and would go hunting, which I got caught for. I skipped communion class or whatever you call it when you're being put into the church. And I got caught for that because that was in the spring. It was in April where there was crappie fishing. I hunted whitetails unsuccessfully until I was about 14. My civics teacher back then, this was late 1970s, and my civics teacher actually gave me a Marlin 44 mag on lend. First, he gave me a .303 Enfield, and he thought, well, you know, that's kind of a primitive thing, so he gave me a 44 mag. He was into whitetail hunting to the max. We were just now getting whitetails, you know, coming back into the country. So my civics teacher and I have a long time running. He was always a friend to me, and he was the kind of teacher that you didn't want to mess up. So I made good grades in his class because I didn't want to be embarrassed by a guy who's a friend, you know. And he and I are friends to this day. He's from Ryland, Alabama. I credit him a lot with a lot of my gun interests. And my parents were really good with buying ammo for Christmas. I got a Browning lever action rifle 308 from 14th Christmas, and that was the end of my Lender guns, you know, and now I had my own.
That's funny, when I was 14, I got my own first gun too.
Yeah.
And it was one of those situations where that was all I wanted. I got asked for a
shotgun.
That's
all I thought about.
My parents would let me bow hunt before I could gun hunt.
Yeah.
And I knew that Dad was going to come through for me. I knew that this was the year I was going to get it. And I had this personal tradition of getting up early from the time I was a little kid and sneaking downstairs and kind of going through the presents and the stocking.
Yeah.
And when I got down there in the middle of the night, there was no gun. There was no box that could be a gun.
Yeah.
And I thought, I can't believe this. And I went back up to bed depressed, and they had to come get me for Christmas. And I'm like, I don't want to come downstairs. You know, whatever. And we go through all of our presents.
All my hopes have been dashed.
Absolutely crushed. Yeah. And I'm through all my presents, and I'm trying my hardest to pretend like I'm thankful. And, you know, they can have all the socks and underwear back, right?
Yeah.
And then my dad just looks at me, and he goes, hey, I got one more for you. And he just flips me this little present. And then, you know, it's 2 inches long and half an inch wide. I open it up. It's a shotgun shell.
Uh-huh.
And there's a note on it that says, you need to go here. And I go there, and there's another shotgun shell. And then another one, and another one. And at the last one says, tell your mom to move. And my mom got up off the couch, and I moved the cushions on the couch, and the shotgun was laid up.
Far
under the,
out.
It was one of the cool, I'll never forget it, you know.
Yeah. Go,
so fortunate to be blessed to have good Christmases every year in my life. But that was so smart on my dad's part.
Yeah.
Mom's part, I don't know who was behind it, one of them. Yeah. But I think it was dad, and it was cool, man.
Well, for sure you ain't going to forget that one.
I'll never forget it for the rest of my life.
Yeah. And that's how, like, that was. That was Christmas, was boxes of ammo and a Browning, like, a 22 with the gold trigger. I remember that one. That was eventually stolen in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
That's too bad.
In a house burglary, when I was finishing college. But, yeah, it was a life, man, steeped in that stuff. I dug ginseng. This was before ginseng was, like, you know, already rare. We didn't hurt it. We replanted the seeds, and we did our best to be ethical even then, you know. And there were paddlefish under the dams. It was just, it was a great place to hunt and fish. I mean, it still is.
And then you ended up going over to Tulane in New Orleans.
Yeah, I did. I was studying Latin American studies. I spent some time in Brazil, in the Amazon. I was really lucky trip. I worked there at a sawmill, kind of through a distant relative connection, took boats all around the Amazon. We shot, I think they're called huatzins, but they call them cegunha. It's like a water turkey. And we used a 20 gauge with a brass shell that you reloaded with powder and toilet paper and shot. The paper shell swelled up in the Amazon, wouldn't fit in a gun. And so the guys who ran this boat, it was a timber boat, they had a brass shotgun shell. You tap the primer in it. So that was like that was another, I fished every chance I got in the Amazon, hand lining. We had no tackle. But I had a blast. I mean, I would go to these river markets, and the people sold this stuff called sharky, and it was big strips of beef jerky. And the little kids were all fishing, you know. Everybody's like subsistence, right? And these ladies would give me, like, piece. I was really young, so I just turned 18, I think. And they all thought I was too young to be off of my own in their country, and they were always nice to me. It was another thing I remember about the Amazon, you know. Anyway, they would give me these strips of jerky, and me and the little kids would go down, and we would handline these catfish and stuff off the docks at the river markets. So it was fishing and hunting there, and then I'd spent some time. I went to Mexico, and I was really into Latin American studies and Latin American history, and I still speak Spanish, and those places were really important to me. And for a long time, and I still want to go back, like hit Baja for the rooster fish, and I was always real comfortable, like in Mexico.
I always dreamed about going, and was fortunate to finally make a trip down to the Yucatan a couple of years ago and harvest a oscillated turkey.
Yeah,
but thankfully I got that done pretty quick in the hunt, and I had a lot of time to explore the Yucatan.
Yeah,
from Merida to Campeche over to Tulum.
Yeah,
and you know, man, for me, forget Snowbirding to Florida. Like, I want a place in the Yucatan.
Yeah, someday. For sure. And like, that coast is incredible.
Oh, it's so beautiful, and the people are so friendly. And you hear up here in America all the time, oh, be careful, don't go to Mexico. There was nothing more dangerous about being in the Yucatan than there was in a St. Louis Saturday night.
It was,
you know, bad things can happen anywhere, but what I experienced down there was friendly people in a beautiful environment, unbelievable natural resources, lots of protections, lots of public lands and wildlife refuges on the ocean. And it's rare when you dream about something for so long that it exceeds your expectations.
Right.
And that's
almost never.
Right.
Yeah.
And my dreams were surpassed.
Yeah. Well, that was a thing for me. We can talk about this later, but I followed that with Bugle magazine. Actually, sent me back to write about elk in Mexico, once I was working as a writer, and that was an incredible trip. I was able, like coming from where I did. So I went to Tulane for 2 years because that was a Latin American studies school. Then I came back to Alabama to finish because it was much cheaper and I could get there quicker. And we had an interior, I've written about this before, we had an interior, my friends and I had an interior map of every piece of public ground within 2.5-3 hours of Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And we hit them all. You know, whether it was squirrel hunting or looking for Bob Whites, which were already in decline. I didn't turkey hunt back then. Or whitetail hunting, I hunted in North Alabama on our property. But we used every bit of public land, and we had trot lines on the Sipsey River in the Sipsey Swamp. And the Sipsey Swamp to this day remains, like you were telling me stuff from your childhood, you know, you just, like, these are the places that were kind of sacred to making you who you were. The Sipsey Swamp is one of those from in college. I found it. It's huge. It's got a lot of good bass fishing, got a lot of good catfish and eels. There's American eels in it. And it was my source of, like, where I went when I couldn't take the town anymore, you know. And I'd love to see it today. I hope it's fared well.
Yeah, those childhood memories and those roots just never fade.
Yeah.
No, they're strong.
And we are who we are, you know. I mean, I fished stripers there in Tuscaloosa. And sometimes when I went to Montana when I was 25, and that was to go to a writer's workshop with Tom McGuane at Yellow Bay on Flathead Lake. I went there on the train, and I looked around. This was 1988. And the next year, I came back and got a job as a ranch manager, because by dint of knowing how to run farm equipment, and they had a haying operation. So that's how I got to Montana.
So that really brings two questions into it for me. When did the writing come in? When did you start your writing, and how did that come to be? When did you know you wanted to be a writer? And then when did you move to Montana permanently?
Right. Okay, so the two things were kind of related. I started out to write fiction, and that was all I was really interested in. I went to Oxford, Mississippi for a while and thought about going there and pursuing a creative writing. And it didn't really call to me. And I wanted to go to the University of Montana, go to creative writing school, and I never did. I mean, you talk about roads never taken, not even thought, you know. But my buddy and my lifelong hunting and fishing partner, and I had a tree planting business based in Tuscaloosa where we planted loblolly pines for the paper companies. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, not an ecologically beneficial practice that we engaged in. And
the renewable resource.
Yeah, it was. But the resource that we replaced, which was the southern hardwood forest, was the most incredible thing ever.
Yeah.
We used to say one of the things that changed our lives, our minds about all this forever, was to leave one of these sprayed and burned and chopped clear cuts. And we had cur dogs back then. And I would hunt whatever, squirrels, whatever. Tree plants in the winter. And you would step from that clear cut, that sprayed place where we worked, into these kind of ravines. It's in South Alabama. And it was like going from hell to Eden.
Hmm.
and it really makes a lifelong impression on you. You step into those, the sweet bay magnolia, it's big oaks, sycamores and stuff with these creeks in the bottoms. And then you say, wow, I think this is nice, you know, compared to that pine plantation we're laying in behind us. And perhaps, and it was renewable in a sense, although they're trying to put a lot of the hardwoods back now.
That's good.
Yeah. But that was a pivotal thing. The reason we started at tree planting companies, we like to work really hard outside. We like being fit and strong, and we wanted to live outside, you know, and that was it. And that was the way you did that. We lived in our trucks, and we had camps, beautiful camps set up, and we lived outside for the whole season, which was Christmas through about April 1st.
That's probably the best time to be outside in Alabama.
Pretty wild, yeah, yeah. Well, we rode through weather like what we have here in Missouri today.
Really?
Yeah, and it would be too cold to plant, and then you'd just be like thrown on the country. We'd drive around, drink beer, look at things.
Growing up on the shores of Lake Michigan, I've just always been a cold weather guy, and
yep.
I just imagine those swamps in the summer at 100 degrees with 100% humidity. And
yeah.
That's just, man, I'd rather be in the cold.
It's for a chosen few. Yeah. We took pride in it. We took pride in working summer and winter outside, you know, and like somebody gave me that thing. It goes, oh, you know, it's just weather. But it was that tree planting. So I had heard that there was great tree planting in the Rocky Mountains and in the Cascades and on the coast, you know, Pacific coast. I ended up doing that in Montana. But that was another thing that brought me to Montana.
And that was down in the Bitterroot?
I started out in the Bitterroot. We wandered around and looked at things and then drifted down into the Bitterroot. I wasn't there very long. I put my name up at a co-op for labor, and I wasn't there very long before these guys hired me on a hay crew, and it turned out he was actually leaving the ranch after that. And so I stepped in, and that was a house provided, truck, all that stuff. It wasn't a lot of money, but it felt pretty good. I mean, yeah.
We had the same dream to go to Montana. You stayed for the rest of your life. I made it 4 years before heading back to the Midwest.
Well, he did yet.
Yeah, that's true. And you do get back to Alabama, but I'll lay a bet that you spend some time in Montana for the rest of your life.
Yeah, it's been hard to leave behind. I mean, I've raised my family there.
It's so beautiful.
It is, and people talk to me about that, and I have tried to explain it to them. I said, it's public lands, it's and stream access. And when I picked a place to raise my children, I wanted a place where there were, and I'm a traditionalist kind of person. I wanted it to be a more traditional, low population place. And I wanted access to I wanted to hunt and fish. And I wanted to do it on public land. And so that's why my kids are basically, they're Montanans. You know, they're born in Montana. They've lived their whole life there. That's what they know.
And you've become one of the leading voices for that in the country.
I wrote my first story about it in 1999. It was published in 2000, called No Place Whatsoever, The Move to Privatize Your Public Lands. And that was for Field and Stream.
So you've been in this fight for quite a while, so we might as well just go ahead and transition into that. So we're talking about federal public lands and what we're facing as a nation right now with the attacks on these. And it's been said to me many times that these attacks aren't new. They've been happening. But I've heard you say that this is the worst it's ever been.
Well, this is the closest those attacks have ever come to a kind of obvious fruition. And what happened was people hated the idea of public lands. It went against the pioneer spirit and utilitarianism like we talked about. And just the idea of setting anything aside for any reason just flew in the face of certain small interests, you know. And they fought it since 1891 when the first forest reserves were put into place. But Bernard DeVoto wrote the best about this. If you ever read his essays it's called The Easy Chair, and it was in Harper's Magazine during the 1950s. And DeVoto wrote a book also called, a seminal essay called The West Against Itself.
I've read the DeVoto version of the Lewis and Clark Journal.
Yeah, he was the editor. Yeah. And now for a tangent, if you want, have you ever read The Big Sky by A.B. Guthrie?
They're both behind you.
Okay.
Look, right behind your head is The Big Sky and the second one.
Yep, gotcha. Yep. And so A.B. Guthrie and DeVoto were friends.
Okay.
And there's pictures of them up north of where I live together. And DeVoto had all of the knowledge that A.B. Guthrie needed to write The Big Sky about the transit, the trips up the river.
That started in Missouri.
Yeah, it started in Missouri.
Up to Montana.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of integrated stuff here. And Guthrie himself became kind of an environmental writer, you know, and thinker. And that did not go over big, like where he was in around Shoto in Montana. Despite the fact that we have the Bob Marshall Wilderness and everybody loves that Lewis and Clark Forest and they hunt on it and do huge pack trips and stuff. Guthrie's environmental, you know, voice wasn't popular even in his day. And he understood it, but you know, Guthrie was an incredible voice. And I don't think Guthrie existed as he was without DeVoto.
Hmm.
They fed each other, you know. And so DeVoto was owned to the privatization movement forever, and he had followed it forever. And anybody who's interested in this needs to go back and read DeVoto's essays on this. He was one of the first people to note that the privatization advocates who were small-scale ranchers were actually arguing for their own extinction. I've written about this, like, a lot, and DeVoto was the first to say, let's talk about like Clavin Bundy. They have 160 acres deeded, and they run cattle over hundreds of square miles of federal public land. Well, there's not enough. You can run any cows on that small deeded parcel. And so the people who are arguing for privatization, and this is, there's less and less of these, I promise, but the ball has been picked up by larger entities now. But it used to be the cattlemen were so furious at the BLM. They were so furious at the Forest Service for one thing or another, you know, that they never articulated that they were grazing lands that they could never afford to own, and that they were paying one of the world's lowest grazing fees on that, and that should they lose that their own deeded place would not be enough to support a ranch, and they would not be the ones buying those lands because those lands are really marginal.
And really, what they pay to be able to graze on those lands is much more affordable in the federal contracts than it would be if they were leasing private land. Is that correct?
It's about 10 to 20 times less.
Yeah.
On the Fed. And that's because we as a people, it's not that they're, I don't like that welfare ranch and stuff. That's not me. Okay. I mean, I live in a ranching community and I've spent 27 years in Eastern Montana. That's not me. The American people have spread out the cost of having a public system of public lands. That's why we have it. And those ranchers are able to use that for, and yes, it's a subsidized cost for sure. But it also maintains rural communities and a lifestyle and a culture that I particularly personally appreciate.
But if those public lands went away, then those low prices would go away.
They're gone, dude.
And they'd have a hard time surviving as ranchers.
It wouldn't be a hard time. They're gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. The state fee, Montana state fee is 8 times what the feds charge.
So they should be bought into or more bought into than they are protecting these
more and more of them are. Yeah, more and more of them are. However, their anger and initial anger has been picked up by people who do not have their best interest at heart either. And that cat has kind of been let out of the bag, and it is rampaging around somewhere else.
Yeah, nothing drives me more insane, upsets me more than when conservation and agriculture butt heads.
Right.
Needlessly. I mean, yep. there's certain things that, you know, we're probably not going to agree on and things that we both need to come to the middle on. But more so than anyone else, farmers are conservationists. They're holding wildlife on their lands. They're feeding wildlife on their lands. And this notion that we can't work together drives me crazy, because one of the career highlights for me so far is my work on the renewal of the Missouri Park Soil and Water Conservation sales tax. It's a sales tax that we have here in Missouri. It's a 1/10 of a cent sales tax that gets renewed, or it's up for renewal every 10 years. And thankfully, it's been renewed since its inception in
It's a stroke of genius.
1984. It really is. And just last year, we renewed it with Farm Bureau, the corn growers, the cattlemen, the Soybean Association, along with the Conservation Federation, the Coalition for the Environment, the Sierra Club. So you've got agriculture, you've got real moderate groups, you've got real far left-leaning environmental groups, all putting aside their specific interests and focusing on, okay, if we pass this tax, it'll benefit all Missourians through our state park system, it'll make our soil healthier and keep more of it on the ground where we need it, and it'll keep it out of our waters, which makes our water supply cleaner and better for all people to drink. Yep. And we passed that tax with an 80.1% of the vote. We were able to prove that if we can just get over ourselves and look at the big picture, that we can actually do things that benefit all of us.
Yep.
And why we can't come together as a nation and do that more often at the state level, at the local level, but also at the federal level.
Yeah. Well, it might be becoming a bit more rare now, but as a rule, we have done that. You know, and we were talking about the Civil War this morning and Missouri's pivotal role in, like, probably some of the most epic battles and struggles of the Civil War. And Shelby Foote, you know, in the Ken Burns documentary.
Oh, yeah.
He says, you know, basically Americans like to think of themselves as these headstrong people who never back up. But the real genius of America has always been compromise. And the Civil War was a place where it failed. And it was actually rare. And that's what Shelby Foote was pointing this out, you know, and we have succeeded in conservation, in environmental protection, more than we have ever failed, ever since we recognize this is a problem to be solved. We're Americans. We're going to get up at 6:30 in the morning and we're going to solve this problem. And by golly, we did.
Yeah. I mean, the history of what we did to create those problems through the 1800s.
Sure.
And the very early 1900s. And then the fact that there was a great awakening.
Yep.
There was a great conservation awakening in the 1920s, 1930s. You know, Roosevelt was a leader of it, but there were many others, Pinchot and Muir and these guys that really opened our eyes to the destruction that was taking place across the country.
Yep.
And the fact that here in Missouri, folks like E. Sidney Stevens and Ding Darling and the Leopolds, they all came together and created this Conservation Federation, and we're still carrying that torch today.
You bet. And it's a success. One of the things that that we'd miss, you know, like when the car successfully traveled from point A to point B and the old lady gets her groceries at the store and somebody helps her out and she goes home, that's not news, right? But when like the car runs off the cliff and then everybody steals the battery, right? That's the story, right?
Right.
And we missed the one where there was against so many odds, we fixed so many things. I just
so the fear now is that they've been fixed for so long, the ebb and flow is taking us into a time period where there's opportunity to start the destruction again.
Absolutely. I see it everywhere.
That's my fear.
I see it everywhere.
So my generation.
The fear is real.
So there's still people. We just lost a man here in Missouri. His name was Bill Crawford. He was 99 years old when he passed away just a month or two ago.
Yeah.
I was able to do a podcast with him. You should go back and listen
to
this. It was an amazing opportunity.
I remember right after you did that, you told me about it.
He was an inspiration to me, and that puts me in a very big boat. He was an inspiration to a lot of people. And he was 17 years old in 1935 when he went to that meeting and sat next to Ding Darling.
Yeah.
And he carried that story forward for 99 years. Well, whatever 99 minus 17 is. And he was able to be our living historian. But he went through that period where there were no deer. He was there at the pivotal moment when we said, we got to bring them back.
Yeah.
Bring them back. That was the slogan. Yeah. Bring them back.
Mm-hmm.
And then he lived and played a big role in the Department of Conservation to implement policies and regulations and seasons that allowed them to flourish.
Yeah.
But now I'm, you know, born in 1979.
Yeah.
And grew up in this era of influx. I grew up in the era of deer just now starting to boom.
Yep.
Up to the peak, to the point where the department has had to change their goal of growing to slowing. Like, okay, we got to slow them down a little bit now. Yeah. We got too many deer.
Right.
And that happened over the course of 80 years.
Yeah. How many deer did you say that went to the food pantry?
Oh, the Share the Harvest program?
Yeah, Share the Harvest program.
It was about 4,500 deer, I believe. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but the way I always talk about it is it's roughly 250,000 pounds, and I try to equate that, which I think I'm being conservative in my estimation, of a quarter pound per meal.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably less than that, but if you equate that to a quarter pound per meal, that's a million meals a year that hunters are putting on the plates of Missourians across the state.
Yep.
And that means a lot to me in the sense of what it is to be a hunter.
Yeah.
You know, when tribes had hunters, like not everybody went out and hunted. That was a job. Like your role was to go procure food and bring it back for those of us that are unable to hunt. Or those
it's an honor, always been an honored role since the beginning of time.
And it still is.
Yeah.
It still is. And to be able to go out and do that and know that, you know, that wildlife animal is now feeding people that don't have the means of putting meat on their table.
That's right. And you and I, when you were telling me this last night, it's not just the absolute, like the destitute or the homeless. This is just like people who need protein. They need meat. And they just, like a single mother who doesn't have a hunter.
Yeah.
And I was blown away by that because hunting, though, it's conservation that produced that.
It is. And we have these pivotal moments that come out of nowhere in life. Like, if you keep your eyes open, they happen to you occasionally.
And
you don't expect it or know it's coming, you know. And I was sitting in a booth at the Lambert's Cafe in Sykeston. And I was getting ready to go over and do a Share the Harvest press conference with Governor Nixon, who is our former governor here and a really strong conservationist. And I'm in my booth and I'm writing my notes and my waitress said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm going to go talk about Share the Harvest." "Well, what's that?" "It's a program that, you know, provides meat to food pantries so people in need of meat can get some."
Yeah.
And she walked off and I didn't think a second thought about it. Next thing I know, there's her and two more waitresses. And these are working Missourians.
Yep.
They have jobs. These aren't people like looking for a handout or on some kind of subsidy program. They're working. And they sit down in my booth and they said, "You know, it gets pretty slow around here in the winter. And how do we get some of that meat?"
Yep.
And it was just like fireworks went off in my head. It was just an absolute explosion of a whole new perspective, a whole new way of thinking about this. And I think society sometimes forgets that welfare was set up to help some people get by. It's not set up to be a means to an end for life.
Right.
But if you're working and you need a little bit of help,
right,
I want to help you. And I think most people feel that way. I think sure. most people want to get people over the finish line that are trying to run the race.
You bet.
And
or those people got children to feed. I mean,
right.
I mean, we're subsistence hunters. You know, my life as a rider, some years, some months are up, some are down, you know, but we are subsistence hunters, and that's what we do for meat. We don't buy that much meat, although we're happy to do so when we want a big beefsteak or something, right? But or get pigs from a friend, especially.
Yeah.
But we mostly live on that, and we don't take that for granted. But, you know, we did an interview with, it was Hannah Jean Ryan in Montana, and they were doing hunter education, and there were single mothers coming there bringing their sons. And Hannah and them were most comfortable with a woman to meet, right? And this, they didn't want to go to some crusty curmudgeon who's been shooting all his life and, you know, started deer hunting when I was one.
Got one of those vests on with a bunch of pins on it.
Yeah, him. Yeah. And
you're holding your gun wrong.
Yeah. And might be, and although they might not be, they also might be condescending. And these gals are busy. They ain't got time for that.
Right.
Right. So they're coming to this and they want to put their sons or their daughters, and they don't feel they aren't qualified to teach them, right? So there's a resource for this new burgeoning aspect of our society who craves outdoor experience, who, and man, they too busy.
Yeah.
If you know some of those women who are working supporting children, they're too busy, you know, to like teach whitetail hunting. It's not gonna happen. So we're in a whole new world, I think, and I don't know how big a demographic it is. I don't really care.
Well, I think we also have a lot of opportunity before us right now to expand hunting into new genres of people.
Yeah.
I've got a friend named Mark who will be down at the cabin this weekend, and he's heard me tell this story before, so I'm not ashamed to say that
yeah.
I judged a book by its cover. I
mm-hmm.
made a mistake,
mm-hmm.
and he works in solar power, and he was with a company called, or an organization called Renew Missouri at the time, and you know, he's the kind of guy that had sides of his head shaved and his hair slicked back,
uh-huh.
and multiple earrings, and we had a meeting of some more environmental type based groups at CFM, and Mark says, "Hey, you know, I'd like to talk to you after this." And I'm thinking, ah, shit. Like, what did I do now? You know,
yeah.
did I use the wrong word? Or, you know, I'm thinking,
yeah.
you know, I think, and, you know, this buddy of mine who's on the left side of things is going to, you know, tell me I did something wrong.
Yeah.
And he just blew my mind when he said, look, I'm really interested in knowing where my food comes from.
Yeah.
And I'd like to start hunting. And it was just like, what's wrong with me? First
yep.
of all, like, why did I,
yeah.
you know, not think that that was an opportunity instead of, you know, judging? And I think we all get that way. We
yep.
all get, you know, our minds made up, and certain groups of people are this way, and certain groups of people
right.
are that way.
And well, it's more comfortable that way, and then you can just cruise around without thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But sometimes our greatest opportunities are in those segments of society
yeah.
where we don't expect it to come from.
You bet.
And I think we're seeing that right now. I think
yeah.
we're seeing. So I think I grew up in probably the worst time for food in American history
mm-hmm.
through the 80s and
mm-hmm.
90s when all this fast food jumped up, and like my mom watched her mom slave in the kitchen.
Yep.
And I think a lot more women in that era started working outside of the home.
Yep.
And we've seen that transition, and McDonald's became so easy
yeah.
before they realized they were feeding their kids pink slime.
Yep.
And so I grew up like I'm a McDonald's baby. Like
yeah.
I grew up on
yeah.
that. And I hate it now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we try not to
mm-hmm.
to do that. Like, I shouldn't say I hate it. I love a Big Mac as much as anybody. But I hate thinking back that I ate so much fast food.
I did, too, in high school, for sure.
And
yeah.
I wish I hadn't. And we don't do that with our kids.
Yeah.
And I think you're starting to see, like, if we're not doing it with our kids probably won't do it with their kids.
Yeah.
And we're trying to get back to a more sustainable way of eating.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about the future of hunting in that aspect.
I am, too. And I like I said, those interviews I did, that was with Liza Sauter and Hannah Jean Ryan. And they opened my eyes to this entire new thing with the women in hunting and women who are interested in passing on, who do not have their tradition, that are passing it on to their kids. And I, if there's anything more positive than that, Brandon, I ain't seen it.
Well, I don't know Hannah, but that Liza, she's an impressive girl.
Yeah.
I mean, what is she, 19 or 20 years old?
Yeah.
And she has the maturity and
she's killed big bulls too.
And she's got her head on straight. I like listening to her talk. When she was on your podcast, it just blew me away. And meeting her at POMA, I mean, it's young ladies like that that give us hope for the future.
Yeah, and she in particular is out like right in front. And I asked them one time, I said, how much stock do y'all have, you know, because they hunt the backcountry. And she said, no, we just hunt on foot.
I heard her talk about packing. I don't think she's as big as an elk haunt herself.
No, but there's a lot of power, man.
But she puts it on her back and gets it out of there. And being the father of daughters, that's exciting to me, to see that we have broken down that barrier and that women, we hear the statistics about the fact that it's one of the fastest growing segments of the hunting population.
Yeah.
And statistics are great, but just seeing women out there and knowing that there's some real authentic enjoyment in it and... You know, I love, more than anything, I love listening to them when they complained about the pink camo. Like, I think it's so derogatory to try to use camo and pink guns as sex symbols. And sometimes I get so frustrated about this, like, men are monkeys sort of mentality that marketing often throws on us. Like, if we put sex in it, we can sell them anything. Like, like this whole class of humanity that's born a male can be tricked into doing or buying anything
by
that.
Yeah.
So I don't want to see, you know, if you like pink and pink's your favorite color, great.
Right.
Get a pink gun.
Right.
But don't try to fool me into thinking, you know, I want women to truly enjoy the outdoors for the reasons that I do. And that's what I'm trying to pass on to my daughters.
Yeah. Yeah. And me too, mine. I mean, my daughter is, she gets it. She's out there hunting with us and she's a shooting, killing machine sometimes when she's on her game. It's a pleasure.
I love about you so much is the fact that When I got involved in the outdoor industry, you know, like so many others, I quickly drank the industry Kool-Aid, and I wanted to be part of that, like, ATA crowd, which is, you know, it's going on right now, and stores across the country have sold out of male jeans with butt bling rhinestones on them, so all these guys can get together and wear them to a pseudo hunting show and brag about how many inches their buck had last year. You being a Montana guy, I'm thinking he's probably got his freezer stocked with elk and antelope and a mule deer. So I'm thinking I'm going to be a good friend and send some whitetail steaks home with you. And you like killed six of them this year.
Yeah. Between me and my kids. Yes. Yeah.
He don't need any of my deer meat. Yeah, you know? No. So like you actually live it, man. Like you're out amongst it and living it. And you've been doing it for so long and you're such an authority on it. And it's through experience.
It is. And it's through passion. Like we were talking about, how did you get to writing, you know? Well, one of the things is I wrote fiction. I published fiction in the late 90s. I published essays. And then I was working in the woods, you know, as a timber thinner and contractor, tree planter, whatever, fire lines. I think I've done every job there is to do on federal public lands in the West. I mean, I can't think of one. I didn't last long as a firefighter. There were too many rules. But... if you can camp out by yourself and do it with a chainsaw, I did it.
Yeah.
So we had a conflict, a real conflict over game farming in Montana about 1990, started in the late 90s. And I happened to be living in a place where there was a big elk farm. And so I got on that story and it paid to write about something I was fascinated by about the same as it did for me. Digging fire line paid by the chain. The chain's 66 feet. You saw the thing out, and then you chop with a Pulaski backs to expose mineral soil for 12 to 14 inches wide for 66 feet, and you get paid, say, $30. So you do 10 chains, you got $300, you know? And so writing stories paid somewhere around that. So it wasn't a big leap for me, and it certainly wasn't a big leap into, like, economic freedom, but I found I had more fun investigating and writing nonfiction and writing journalism than I did digging fireline or even thinning timber, which I enjoyed, but the wages were terrible.
You opened a can of worms. I don't know if you knew you were doing that or not. You opened it on the game farm, and of course that's something that we've been dealing with here in Missouri a lot.
Which blows my mind, because in my brain, I was a CWD guy for Field and Stream back a long time ago. In my mind, we had begun to settle this 20 years ago. So that I was not aware of the conflict, I got to tell you.
Yeah, no, it's growing across the East as well. Yeah. Thankfully, here in Missouri, because of our constitutional authority that's being challenged right now, we've been able to at least keep it somewhat in check.
Yeah.
But now you look at states like North Carolina, West Virginia, my home state of Indiana, where General Assembly's legislatures, state legislatures, are just bending over backwards to roll out the red carpet for these jobs,
right,
of growing wildlife in captivity so people can come fake hunt.
Right.
And here in Missouri.
And putting their own wildlife resource in dire jeopardy at the same time.
Right.
Including the vast amount of taxpayer dollars and license fee dollars that will be paid to try to reduce that jeopardy.
Well, we have a senator here that carries the water every year for them. So far, legislation hasn't been filed in 2018, but that's because on January 10th, the Supreme Court heard the case against the Department of Conservation. So the department back a couple of years ago tried to put in place regulations that would eliminate the importation of deer into our state. Myself and others don't think these regulations go far enough.
Mm-hmm.
We would like to see double fencing or... You know, I'm not ashamed, or I don't hide the fact that I'd like to see it just go away altogether,
right,
the way Montana did in 2000.
Right.
That's, you know, nobody's head is spinning to hear me say that right now.
Yeah.
But if banning the importation of them is the first step, or if that's what we believe scientifically is going to help keep CWD from becoming worse than it already is in our state, then I'll be the first one to carry that flag.
Yeah.
A lawsuit was filed. A lot of history with the judge. You know, you can pick any county you want to file your lawsuit in. So it was filed in a real rural location. And that judge initially sided with the plaintiffs that brought the case. Deer farmers that brought, and I don't even like to use that deer farmer term, deer breeders that brought the case against the department. It went to the appeals court. The appeals court ruled just so dramatically in favor of the department, we didn't think it would even go to the Supreme Court. I mean, it was a definitive ruling out of three judges on the appeals court. But thankfully, it did go to the Supreme Court, and we're hoping that this Supreme Court ruling will be, once again, a strong reformation of the authority the department has based on the state constitution to manage all wildlife.
Yeah.
So the fact of the matter is we're just... deep in the captive wildlife fight.
Yeah, it's a nutty fight, and I am the first to recognize the rights of a private property owner to do what they want with their property.
But those rights should stop when they start infringing upon the rights of everyone around you.
Well, you also have a recognized, not just CWD, but recognized disease events, which if you go to Canada, if you go to Alberta, back the depopulation of the elk herd, the captive elk herds, because of bovine tuberculosis, and they had a CWD event as well. But you know, you beyond the private property issue, which I'm okay with, there's public monies. There's putting things at risk, not just the ethics of hunting, which I think you and I touched on the other day. Ethics are a good lawmaker, or a good lawyer can argue that ethics are for, you know, individual things, but public money is not. And this is, there are recognized precedents for saying, holy smokes, watch out.
And that's where I started to go with talking about the senator that carries the water. We were in a hearing last year in the Senate, and I was really prepared. It was great. I had my manila envelopes full of information.
Yeah.
And once in a while, they'll just lob one up for you, you know, and you get lucky. And he said, Mr. Butler, do you know what happens when one of these deer breeder facilities is found to have a positive? I said, sir, I do. They're depopulated. And how do you feel about that? How do you feel that financially affects the livelihoods of these farmers? And I said, well, sir, I think it'll be all right. Because in this instance, where this deer farm was depopulated, the farmers received $1.2 million of taxpayer money for those 300 whitetails. And that was, those numbers aren't exactly right, but it was something like that. Yeah. It was up in Iowa.
Yeah.
And I had a Department of Agriculture press release from Iowa that, you know, the depopulation of that herd cost the taxpayers over $1 million.
Go look at the figures in Alberta during the attempt to control bovine TB during the 90s.
So how is it my responsibility that this herd that's shipping animals around in a trailer somehow ships the disease in that infects the rest of their herd?
Which animals get killed,
and we got to pay.
Yeah.
And we got to, and it's like, well, those animals aren't saleable anymore. Now it's the taxpayer's responsibility to make this, you know, family whole.
Right. I don't know. I've never gotten it. And I don't. Montana actually has a cap on the amount of money can be paid per animal. It has nothing to do with game farming. Mm-hmm. It has to do with a far-seeing bunch of ranchers back in a long time ago, homestead days, mm-hmm. who foresaw that the taxpayers couldn't really pay for that. And I think it's $45 a head. You're in big trouble if you got to depopulate there.
And to turn the coin over, you know, you look at the, like, Paradise Valley in Montana, one of my favorite places on the planet, and the bison that come out of Yellowstone.
Yep.
Breaks my heart to think that they shoot those bison
because
they're coming. But I understand it,
and
I don't fight against it.
Mm-hmm.
If those bison are going to come on to those cattle ranches.
Yeah, they got
to
pass that private land.
And potentially, you know, infest a cattle herd with brucellosis.
Yep.
That's not okay.
Yep.
That's not okay. Right. I understand it. Well, I wish I could hold a sign and tell that bison to turn around and go back in.
There, that's a huge conflict because verification of that is really nebulous.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to see those things go north, Town Minor Basin, and into the Gallatin National Forest where I could hunt them with some beauty of... I've been on that bison hunt several times, and I got nothing against it, and I would do it. But it's not really hunting. And if they were on the Gallatin National Forest, it would be.
Yeah.
And one of my dreams is for us to solve this.
Right.
And to have those public land in these big grasslands where I used to build trail when we were trail contractors.
Well, aren't they starting to consider repopulating them in the Missouri Breaks with Charlie Russell?
What are you trying to do, set off a gasoline bomb on the podcast?
Did I just open a can of worms?
Oh, man. The average pickup truck east of me has a big bumper sticker that says, "Don't buffalo me."
Don't buffalo me.
You know, it's on fire. It's not... It's just, like, so controversial.
Really?
Yeah.
What's that? Is it the American Prairies?
American Prairie Foundation. They have buffalo.
And they're trying to bring them...
They have a lot. And they're in kind of a game-friendly buffalo fence. And they are repopulating. And they have a huge amount of BLM lease grazing land. And the buffalo roam, you know. But as far as reintroducing wild herds, it's incredibly controversial.
What do you think's going to happen?
Have no idea. It won't happen for quite a while. And I'm not saying Republican or conservative, either one. Some of these ranchers who live north of the breaks and whatnot, they're totally legitimate. They don't want the buffalo crashing through their fences every winter, stampeding their cows or doing whatever. You got to talk to them.
Yeah, they've got a legitimate concern.
Totally. And they got big pieces of private ground that they work really hard. It's really hard to live there. And they don't need an added stressor.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm listening to them. I'm not necessarily agree with them, you know, because I like buffalo and I would love to see them. I'd love to see thundering herds of buffalo, right? But that's in a different kind of world, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys got to be listened to.
Absolutely.
They're good folks.
Yeah. And that's my point, is it goes both ways. The things that we hope for and want to see.
Yeah.
But when you talk about white-tailed deer, you know, you hear about the economic impact these game ranches have. That economic impact is pocket change compared to what wild whitetails bring into the rural economy of this
state.
That's
right.
I mean, we're talking about $2 billion a year in people that come into the rural part of Missouri to purchase food and hotel rooms and tire repairs.
Yeah.
You know, you had to get a tire repair.
Yeah, I'm still looking for the definitive tire repair.
So, you know, I just don't understand that economic argument. Like, we have over 1 million wild whitetails, you know, maybe 1.2, 1.3 million wild whitetails.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about this just minute industry.
I'll jump up one or down one level from the economics of it. Look at the relationship of human beings, like we were talking about the hunters being honored, male or female hunters honored as the meat bringers to, you know, to back to your home. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the beauty of quid pro quo benefiting everything when you have wildlife, healthy wildlife, and the culture of hunting and how none of that is present in deer breeding operations. That's not present. I wrote an essay 100 years ago. I don't know when I first started out. I said, I've always liked cattle. I'm interested in cattle. I live in a cattle place. But the early hunters, they don't do Holsteins on the walls of the caves. You do bison. You do the wild animals that live these inscrutable lives out there, and you go and connect with them. And there's this deep relationship of man and game, you know, and it's cultural, especially like in y'all's part of the Ozarks where those people live so far out, you know, and you know they're subsistence hunters and fishermen, and they, it's just this cultural, and it's so healthy. It's so strong and so healthy, man.
One thing that's special about Missouri and the fact that we do have a dedicated tax is that whether you want to be or not, you're financially invested in the conservation, yep, of this state.
Yeah.
And if you say, people say, well, how does that benefit me? Well, how do you feel when you see a bald eagle fly over? Like, how do you feel when you, yep, gaze across a vista and see trees, healthy forests, yeah, changing colors?
Yeah.
And I mean, people often just associate it to the hunting and fishing, but it's that feeling of wildness and wild places.
Yep.
And the fact that wildlife exists.
Yep.
You know, those horses, I showed you the wild, yeah, horses.
What a bizarre thing.
Right. So people, yeah, get so enthralled about the wild horses. Yeah. You can take a picture of those wild horses, put it on Facebook and get,
yeah,
400 likes.
Yep.
Or you can take a picture of a deer and put it on Facebook and get 2 likes because, yeah, it's so, you know, it's just, they're like horses, wild, yeah, wild, yeah, horses. Like,
yeah,
but sometimes they don't go far enough to think about all the wild critters, yeah, all the wild animals that we still have in this state. Crazy ones like the endangered hellbenders.
Yeah, man. I grew up in a river where they had those. Yeah.
The wildlife, it's just so inspiring to, yeah, know that there's still animals living that way.
Well, Brandon, every one of our myths, and I'm teaching a class. I know you're doing it, venturing into teaching too. And I've never done this before, but they say, what do you want to talk about? What is conservation journalism? What is the literature? And you say, and I said, well, first I think we start with what is our mythology as a people, and it's all the bear. And these wild animals, these wild places, these mysteries that are the basis of all of our cultural myths. Now, all of our fairy tales start with somebody entering the dark wood back in Europe, right?
Yeah, Robin Hood.
Robin Hood, and then the people who meet the actual like weird talking bear, right? And it's in the middle of nowhere, and he could either kill you, you know, or show you something. And it's this stuff is so deep. And to make it cheap, to cheapen it or something, it goes against, and it's an ethical thing, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't want it. I don't ever want to see it like cheapened.
And it is.
Yeah, sure.
It's horribly cheapened.
Sure.
That's where it really saddens me. Mm-hmm. Is that? So I get asked a lot, like, who are the people doing this? And some of them are very aware of what they're doing, but in my mind. And I've read so many things about myself online, you know, like just the fake, and you get it too. I know,
yeah,
you get it even worse than I do, but well, how does he know he's never even been on one of those places? Well,
yeah.
How do you know I've never been on one of those,
right,
places?
Right.
For the record, I've been on those places.
Yeah.
I've never killed anything on them, but I, yeah, went there and took photographs before. I did product testing days on places like that.
Yeah.
A couple times I didn't know I was going to places like that. It was just, hey, we're going here to do this today and shoot,
yeah,
these bows. And you get there and they're like, oh yeah, this is Samson. He's $25,000.
Yeah.
You know, this is Zeus and he's $20,000. And can you believe that 4 guys flew in, shot 4 deer. They were gone by 3 o'clock and I made $104,000 that day, you know, pumping the chest. And I'm like, that's horrible. That's horrible.
Yeah.
And
oh no.
You know, so these executives need things to do. And it's, hey, have you ever been hunting? You want to go hunting? Well,
yeah.
I don't have a gun. I don't know the first thing about hunting.
Yeah.
I'll take care of that. I'll take care of that. So maybe this guy's brother-in-law has been hunting his whole life and has killed one nice 8-pointer or,
yeah,
one good 10-pointer or something like that. And now this guy gets to go on a trip. he shows up, has a breakfast, no reason to get up early, goes out and shoots a buck bigger than anything he ever dreamed existed,
right, sure.
because they don't exist like yeah, that in
right,
the wild.
Right.
And then, you know, 6 months later, a crate shows up with a mount that's paid for, and it goes on the wall, and, ooh, me, big hunter, yes,
yeah.
you know. And,
yeah.
Like, they don't, I think some of them just don't know what they're doing. Like, I think some of them are just.
I think you're probably right. I interviewed a lot of them for a long time ago, a piece I did for the Atlantic Monthly. They were, they weren't like bad people.
No.
One guy said.
They're business people.
Yeah. And one guy said, not many people got time to like get on a horse and be in the snow and stuff.
Then they should go golfing.
It was really, but they really want to take a nice bull. And one guy said, I'd only gotten these dink bulls and I think he was public lands hunting. And I only in this hunting, and he just didn't have time or the passion for it. It was very interesting interviewing those folks.
It's fake.
Yeah.
It's not real.
Right. I'm selling you an experience. Or yeah. I'm not selling you an experience. I'm selling you an animal.
Yeah.
There is no experience.
It's like getting a trophy, but you didn't play the game.
Right. Yeah. You never got out on the football
didn't
field.
Didn't even
right.
show up.
Everybody's a winner.
Everybody gets a trophy.
You're all winners.
All right, yeah. We got to change the subject.
Yeah, I hear you, man.
Let's go back to the Ozarks. And you know, you're a guy who's been all over the world.
Yeah.
You know, spent a lot of time in some of the prettiest, most pristine, rural places this country has to offer.
Yeah, mostly this country, yeah.
And you've, for the first time, experienced the Ozarks. Now, you did experience it on the coldest night I've ever been down there.
Yeah.
But just give me your 10,000-foot view.
Well, the 10,000-foot view is that I had no idea that of the vastness of that region or the size of the Ozark National Forest or the Mark Twain.
Ozark in Arkansas.
Yeah, the one in Arkansas
that don't know,
is where I started out.
You were visiting our friend Johnny Sane
yeah.
down in Arkansas.
Yeah, and we wandered that forest. But I think all my life, I have some old outdoor writer stuff that I read as a little kid, and one of them, and I don't know the author, was smallmouth fishing in the Ozarks. The other one was Harry Middleton's book, The Earth is Enough, and it's about a little kid raised by these old grandfather and great uncle or something like that in the Ozarks. I recommend it to you. It's hard. He was from outside of Birmingham, Alabama. He worked at Southern Living or something for a long time. Couldn't do that. Wrote these incredible books and then went back home, actually, and was a garbage man. And not an unhappy garbage man.
Yeah, you know, just like, a guy working outside.
Yeah, for sure. But so I was steeped in the idea of the Ozarks, but I had never imagined that it was so overwhelming. One, so vast. Two, that those rivers were so incredibly beautiful set in there. And the other is the hardwood forests are slightly different than Alabama's, but I am a sucker for those giant expanses of white oaks. And then we got up on top and there's shortleaf pine.
Mm-hmm.
I recognize all of y'all's trees.
Yeah.
I mean, and they're just slightly different because we're moving towards the prairie. And so the juxtaposition of the Ozarks and the Great American Prairie, it's got to be one of the most dramatic things in American, like, we call this topophilia, a love of landscape, right? And I'm a topophile, I guess, you know? And this has got to be, like, one of the most powerful places for all of that.
It's amazing. I mean, I've got 68,000 acres of wilderness out of my back door, and thanks to one guy. Mm-hmm. There's a guy named Leo A. Dry who recently passed away. Had an incredible long life and left an impact that's going to benefit those of us that are still here and those of us that come after us. He grew up in St. Louis and just was frustrated with the practice of clear cutting. And he decided to use his inheritance to buy up as much land
uh-huh.
as he could. And this is in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
And he ended up with a little over 160,000 acres. I want to say 168,000 acres of land at a cost average of $4 per acre.
Yeah.
And,
wow.
And protected that land and started implementing his belief of select cut.
Yeah.
And he'd go in and pick tree by tree by tree. And then he donated that land to a foundation that he created. And it's part of the Conservation Federation called the LAD, the Leo A. Dry Foundation.
Okay.
And that land is open to hike, to hunt, to
yeah.
camp. It's pretty much managed like a wilderness. Like
yeah.
No motorized vehicles, no.
Is that the headwaters of Sinking Creek, too? Does it rise up in there?
No, I don't. Honestly, I'm not sure. I think the headwaters of Sinking Creek is in the Mark Twain National Forest.
Okay. I just so y'all got some of the healthiest rivers.
Oh, they're beautiful.
I mean, I know some of them are just blasted spring fed, but you got to protect the spring too. But the rivers are so healthy in the Ozarks. I think that's another thing that just was powerful to me.
It's so fun for me to take my daughters down there. And like, we live rural, you know, where we're at right now in Fayette. And we got an eagle in the tree behind us this morning we were looking at and taking pictures.
Well, y'all
pictures
got that incredible pond down there.
There's an eagle on the tree by the pond this morning. And there's turkeys in the field across the street. So this morning, I had to go get eggs and bacon to feed Hal an omelet. So I got to take pictures of a bald eagle and turkeys on my way 6 miles from home to the grocery store and back. So I love living this way.
Mm-hmm.
And this is North Missouri, and the cabin's obviously in South Missouri. But
it's still, the diversity here is amazing because you are transitioning to the prairie, and you are transitioning from, one of the things about that clear cutting thing, now we've gotten into this polarized deal about logging, you know, in the West especially, where the environmentalists want to stop this logging or that logging and stuff, and people want to get back to cutting more. And I'm often on the side of cutting a little bit more, right? But I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't want to push that bowling ball off that set of steps, right? Because what's that guy's name? Dry?
Leo Dry.
Leo Dry. What he witnessed is what I witnessed in the South in the 80s, right? And that was not sustainable, and that was not a good idea, okay? And what Champion International did outside of Missoula, Montana in the 80s, which Dick Manning wrote an incredible book called The Last Stand. He was the reporter at the Missoulian at the time. That was not a good idea. And it was not sustainable, and it was not ecologically, or it wasn't good for hunting, it wasn't good for watersheds. So in this debate we have, and I love timber. Mm-hmm. I mean,
I
plant trees, and I'm a sawyer too. Yeah. I take them down, and I love big white oak boards like are in those sawmills around your cabin.
Uh-huh.
And when you bought a big load of Eastern Red Cedar, well, all of my pocket money in high school was paid for by cutting cedar pulp for the pulp mill, the chip mill, where they made press board out of cedar, and then you put it in closets to keep moths out of your woolens, right? And that mill's still running, but I still sell cedar pulp, and we need to do some down there now where I'm in Alabama on our property. And so I love timber, but that selective cutting and all that stuff, there was a big problem. You know, we don't need to forget that back in the day when the Pisgah National Forest in North Carolina was collapsing into the and filling up the watersheds because there wasn't any trees left, and it was abandoned until the Weeks Act of 1911 allowed Congress to allocate our money to pay for it and try to rehabilitate it, you know, abandoned and filling up the creeks in the Appalachians until they flooded out people and towns. The disasters of Monongahela, these disasters came from absolutely unsustainable, devil may care, devil take the hindmost clear-cut logging. And it happened. We can't pretend it didn't. We don't have to be stuck by it. You know, it happened. What Leo Dry saw is real.
Oh, yeah. And now we all get to benefit from it. And it's not like he's some crazy environmentalist just standing there protecting all the trees. He's just saying there's another way to do this.
Yep.
And, you know, I'm not a forester, and I'm not like you. I don't spend a lot of time, you know, working professionally in that industry, but I just like the idea of what he said.
Yeah.
So I hired a guy that works for that organization now to do the timber on my property.
Yep.
And he came and you saw it.
It looks good.
It
man.
Looks great.
Yeah.
And I got a nice chunk of change out of it. And I'm
happy. Somebody somewhere is going to have some beautiful white oak boards.
Yeah.
To do something beautiful with.
And yet there's still a lot of white oak left.
Yep.
So, you know, they came in. I got back about almost a third of what I paid for the property.
Yeah.
And they didn't scar it. I mean, I got a bunch of tops down and stuff, but we're going to get those chopped up.
You're going to be firewood and all of that.
We're going to be firewood rich for a couple of years.
Yep.
So I not only did I financially profit, but I feel good about what I did.
Yep. Yeah. It looks great. I mean, and that's a part of the property we have in Alabama. We're enrolled in the Alabama Treasure Forest Program. We haven't done it in a long time, but we've cut and managed quite a bit of timber. We made wildlife openings. We did an experimental yellow poplar planting, which is now 30 something years later taken off. It can be done. This is when you talk about what keeps you in environmental reporting, what keeps you in conservation reporting. Like I write about conservation, the Everglades, Louisiana. You know what it is? It's that you can just look at it and say, "Hey, man, you could fix that."
Right.
Or wait a minute, if you do that, then this is going to happen. It ain't going to be good. We're going to use all this public money to try to fix it. So let's figure out a way you can do that without wrecking it, you know. And I swear people call me naive. They call me, well, at Field & Stream, sometime on Facebook, I'm called every name in the book, you know, beginning with libtard.
Me too.
And you're
a guy that carries a gun everywhere you go and, yeah. and cuts trees down and hunts all your own, but you're some kind of liberal.
Yeah, for sure. and they don't get to share time with me on the range. You know, they don't get to share time with my daughter and my son and I out handgunning. So they don't know. And I'm okay with that. But the thing that held me in it is that you can look at the Everglades, you can look at Louisiana, you can look at some of these timber battles. You can say, hey, man, that ain't no big deal. We can fix that.
Right.
and
fix things we do.
And again, we already have a million things. You know, we are the beneficiaries of conservation, hard work, and hard decisions for decades.
Almost the last century.
Yep.
The last century.
Yep. And we were the best at wrecking it. Don't ever let anybody say we were buffalo conservationists before, you know.
Yeah, the century before us.
Yeah.
You know.
And we've become the best in the world at fixing it.
Yeah.
That's something I'm super proud of.
We were talking about the health of the rivers, and I started to talk. We got off on the turkeys and eagles up here, but I just love taking these kids down there.
I bet.
You know, the Missouri River is right here. You know, we're just 4 miles as a crow flies from the river. And you go stand by that river, and it's awe-inspiring in its own way, but it's called the Big Muddy for a reason.
Yep.
You know, it's a big brown river, and
all
of our streams up here are running through ag lands and, you know, a lot of runoff and soil and stuff in there.
Yeah, we got a terrible problem with that right now.
You know, so these aren't the rivers that kids are swimming in.
Yep.
We get them down to the Ozarks, and you know, my daughters bring their friends, and there's no Wi-Fi. There's no cell service.
Right.
So they're forced into the outdoors.
Yep.
And those girls, they caught, the last time they were down there before it got too cold, I think they caught over 30 crawfish off that underwater bridge there.
Yeah.
And then they built a habitat in a cooler for the crawfish.
Yeah.
And then they started naming them, you know, and keeping them. And they kept them overnight.
Yeah.
And then they went and released them all back the next morning. But it's like that connection. I know for a fact that it's primal in those situations.
You bet.
Because even though we do everything we can to suppress it,
mm-hmm.
through society.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you turn those kids loose in the woods, it shows itself.
They go right back. Yep, that's right. And they go to where the power is. And the power is in other, what are those other creatures doing?
Yeah.
Right? What do they do? What does that thing look like? Why does it look so different than me? You know, what do they eat?
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Had it always been for you the mystery?
What's over the next ridge?
Yeah.
What's down in that holler?
What's down in that holler?
I got to swim down to the bottom of the creek and see what fish are swimming down there.
Yep. And if I drift a big night crawler down through there, I'm going to figure out what's in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I love it. Unexplored places, wild places.
Yeah.
That's just what I live for.
Yep.
I'm afraid to go to Alaska. I've never been. I'm afraid I won't come back. I have this history of moving places I love.
I know.
Right?
I know.
So I did it to Montana.
Yeah.
I've done it to Missouri. Now I'm down in the Ozarks. I love the Ozarks, though. I mean, for a guy who likes everything, I mean, the turkey hunting down there is just, it's unparalleled.
Yeah.
I mean, because the numbers are there and the terrain is there. So my uncle is, you know, he's my best hunting buddy, and he came down this year, and his theory on turkey hunting is, forget these ninja turkeys. I'm going back to Indiana and killing a cornfield bird. You know, he sets his blind up on the
ninja
corner.
Ninja turkeys in
he
the
calls
far deep
them
forest. Yeah.
Ninja turkeys.
Yeah.
And they are, man.
Yeah.
Like, they're just smart. They've been around a while and they got predators. There's mountain lions trying to kill them. There's coyotes trying to kill them.
If you're dull witted, you're done.
You're done turkey.
Yeah.
And so the turkey hunting's hard, which I appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. We got great deer. I mean, everybody has this misconception that all the Ozark deer are small. They're,
mm-hmm.
I'll tell you, they're not.
Oh man, you know my story. Coming out of Eminence.
Yeah.
I would say 15 miles north towards your place, I saw one of the most spectacular whitetail bucks. It's still like printed in my mind, and it was incredibly symmetrical and heavy.
Yeah. That's the thing. They get
just a real animal, man.
They do a lot of rubbing on cedars, yeah. So they get a chocolate look to their antlers,
yeah.
And they've got great mass. Yep. You know, they don't get as like like the monstrous looking racks, but they get thick and gnarly, and they represent the region. That's what I like about it.
I believe it. And what I saw was a prime representative of the region. Yeah. It changed my experience here seeing that deer on the side of the road.
That's cool.
And he turned and booked too. He wasn't standing there waiting on anything.
We didn't get to ride home together. You followed me, but I don't know if you noticed all the deer that were out in fields last night.
I did. Yep.
It was impressive. I mean, it's not always that way. I think the cold obviously drove them out earlier.
Yeah.
But between Eminence and I think it got dark on us just north of Rolla.
Yeah.
There was a lot of deer and turkeys. Did you see that big wad of turkeys?
I did not.
Just that's when I was trying to point out the window at you.
Yeah.
There was deer back, and I was like, he's going to see the deer.
Yeah.
But there was probably 50 turkeys down in a swale in a pasture. It was amazing. So.
One of the things that I got here, and as I travel across the United States, and I do this every couple of years, I drive to Alabama and back, and I try to think about, like, and I love working at Field and Stream, and I'm doing some stuff there that I'm really enjoying right now, and I think of who's reading this, you know, and I think there's places around the Tennessee River where everybody's hunting and fishing, bam, like everybody.
Right.
Then I come into Arkansas, and it's, you got the Delta and all that stuff, and everybody, but in Missouri is like the heart of rural America. It is not all plowed. It's smaller. There's small farms. There's cattle. There's a lot of breaks. There's a lot of cedar breaks between fields that provide edge habitat and stuff. And I feel like you're in one of the places where, like, for Field and Stream readers, there's a lot of people here reading Outdoor Life, Field and Stream, doing like we did growing up.
Yeah.
It's here, man, and it's very, there's a lot of Missouri. It's big.
It is. And it's diverse.
And it's really diverse. And people are outside.
Yeah. I mean, we've got the Mississippi River and the Missouri River. Huge catfish and everything that comes with the bottomlands of those. We have the Mississippi waterfowl migration and the Missouri waterfowl migration coming together. We've got waterfowl hunting here that is just unparalleled.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just phenomenal. And we have the resources at our Department of Conservation to put habitat on the ground to hold and bring those ducks back.
You bet.
We've got some, I mean, Grand Pass, Eagle Bluffs, Ted Shanks. We've got these legendary conservation areas dedicated to duck hunting and waterfowl hunting. Then we've got the ag field for geese.
Yeah.
We've got trout. We've got smallmouth. We've got largemouth. Yeah. We didn't even touch on Lake of the Ozarks.
Right.
Truman, Smithville, Stockton, Mark Twain. I mean, we've got both Truman and Lake of the Ozarks are over 50,000 acres.
Yeah.
And the fishing that we have here, like all the BASS tournaments come through Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
The quail hunting, we were one time and quail are down, but because of our resources, we're bringing them back. Quail hunters are seeing a resurgence.
Well, that's one of the things driving up here with the fields, the broken fields with edge habitat and stuff. I saw what I saw growing up in Alabama when we had quail hunting.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's not.
It's hard to get them back, dude.
It is, and there's more pieces to the puzzle as to why they're not coming back.
Yep.
But that said, I have friends that go out and lift half a dozen to 10 coveys in a hunt on public lands.
Yeah.
And they'd kill me if I told you where.
Yeah.
But it's in Missouri. In Missouri.
Right.
You know, there are places that you can go have quail hunts that your grandpa would have been proud of.
Yeah.
And boy, I just want to get you back in the summer.
Yeah, well, I'm coming. the smallmouth thing is my first, is what attracts me first.
That was so cool when we went to Alley Spring.
Yeah.
So we went to Alley Spring, and I've always heard tell that if you can get to where Alley Spring dumps into the Jack's Fork at the coldest times of the year, the smallmouth will suck up into that spring branch because that water's 52 degrees coming out of the ground. And now the creek, I don't know what it is, Jack's Fork's probably, you know, it's in the 30s. I'm sure it's cold. We touched it and it's cold, right? So them fish are leaving 35 degree water to go to 52 degree water.
Yeah.
And I've walked around Alley Spring. That's the place I take people, you know. I've never seen a fish like that in there before. And what were there, like 30, 40?
Probably 30. But the ones that stand out were, they were just slightly deeper than the 12 and 14 inches. And they were those big old studs of just, or sows.
Yeah, 4 or 5 pound smallmouth.
4 or 5 pound smallmouth, just suspended in that blue water, dude.
In Alley Spring.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we still haven't figured out if you can fish that. I got to go look at the regulations tomorrow.
You got it. But I was, if you notice what I was doing, I grew up around those springs in Alabama. And you let them go, but I had minnow traps in there. And we had every one of those weird darters, you know, that people argue about, like the snail darter, or the teleco darter, all that stuff, right? Those things. And then we had these minnows that were, you could see all the way through them because they lived underground their whole lives.
Yeah.
And I have been fascinated, and my sister's a painter, right? I told you. And what she paints a lot of is these big springs around the country. I have been fascinated with the creatures in those springs all my life, since, like you were talking about your kids going after those crawdads. When I was little, I went to the spring hole and started just looking at stuff, you know. Yesterday, I was just, I was obsessed with that place, you know, and then sure enough, here's the big wolf pack of monster smallies.
I've never seen that before. And I told you I saw that chain pickerel.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a big deal. Bet. But then when we walked up there and I'm talking to you about smallmouth.
Yeah.
And I looked down and I said, holy, you thought they were carp at first.
Yeah.
They were so
big.
Well,
one of them was so big. Yeah. I was like,
smallies.
Yeah.
Crazy. So yeah. This year I had all these kids down on the Jack's Fork over 4th of July. I was telling you how that's going to be my big family retreat every year for the 4th of July. I'm going to try to bring family and friends to the cabin. And they were fishing. We were on the Jack's Fork. And I took a snorkel, and I went ahead of the fishermen, and I snorkeled down the river, and I would be like, okay, there's smallmouth under this log, there's smallmouth right here by this boulder, you know, and sure enough, my wife and other people were catching them as I was pointing them out. And so my uncle's a scuba diver, and we're just going to get tanks, and we're going to just do that. I want to find a hellbender. That's one of my bucket list things.
And I've seen them caught on a cane pole.
The hellbenders?
Yep.
No kidding.
In Alabama, but I've never seen one in the water like that. And we do a lot of snorkeling in Montana during the very hot of the year.
Uh-huh.
And looking at trout and
It's fun, isn't it?
So it's incredible.
Hey, we can go on and on and on, but I'm already over my limit.
Yeah, man, I'm good, man.
Quite a bit. We've been talking. Again, if you guys don't know Hal Herring, look him up. I mean, this is one of the foremost conservation riders in the country. Look for him in Field and Stream. Where else can people?
I do High Country News a lot. High Country News has been really good to me in publishing like big stories that nobody else wanted to touch. Mm-hmm. I tend to do, as you know, I'll take the controversy. I like it.
Yeah, you don't shy away from
I don't shy away from nothing.
Me neither. And the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, a really strong group that's just growing rapidly out of Missoula, Montana, focusing heavily on the protection of our public lands. And I'm really proud to say that we got a chapter up and running here in Missouri now. They're in their infancy. They got some fight nights coming. Looking for them to be another, as soon as they're officially established, looking for them to be one of the new affiliates to the Conservation Federation.
Yeah, I'm proud to be. This podcast was their idea. The one that I've been doing. I'm on this long tour, right? Not your podcast. But right. I'm on this long tour.
So Hal recorded me for a podcast before I recorded him for a podcast.
And I just think I love what they're doing. What Backcountry Hunters and Anglers are doing right now is people should just pay attention and see what you think, you know?
Yeah. I'm a member.
Yeah.
Proudly. And Hal hosts their podcast.
Yeah.
So you can listen to him on that if you like this podcast format. What are any other magazines that might come across people's desks in Missouri?
Right now, I mean, I did a lot of Nature Conservancy stuff over the years. They hadn't hollered at me lately. I've been really busy doing Field and Stream and High Country News. And I do Montana Outdoors anytime I can, our state wildlife magazine.
I subscribe to that still.
It's a great. And we did a story on Wolverine study that was going on where we took the snowmobiles back at 17 below and put beaver legs up in trees. And if you've never hammered a 10 penny nail through a beaver leg at 17 degrees below zero while suspended up in a tree, it's a very unique thing. One thing you can learn is on snowshoes at 17 degrees back in the woods, it's not bad. You're fine. You're moving around. You're climbing over deadfall, bad snow. On a snowmobile at 17 degrees below zero, I can't imagine anybody choosing to do that. But the wolverines, of course, are just like gamboling about like it's summer in the high country, you know. So Montana Outdoors have been really important to me. They're just the right kind of folks, man.
That magazine's it's incredible.
Yeah.
I love getting, I still, you know, the Missouri Conservationist that we get here is great. And then I still subscribe to the Montana Magazine and the Indiana Magazine.
Yeah. Well, you got a good, you've got a good overview.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm enjoying doing some of this gun writing too right now for a website called Range 365, which is a Bonnier Media thing, mm-hmm. and Filmstream also is owned by. And they've really been nice to me. I did like the history of the Johnson County War and the guns that they used there. The Johnson County,
that's the
Wyoming.
Billy the Kid thing?
Nope. This was it gave rise to Tom Horn, but it was a war between, say, homesteaders and established cattlemen in 1892 in Wyoming. And people can look that up because
Billy the Kid was Lincoln County War.
Lincoln County War, New Mexico.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've always been fascinated, and this is Missouri is, I mean, if I had my druthers, I'd take a month for Missouri. Because when I did a book on historic firearms and guns and gunfighters, and I mean, Missouri comes up first and foremost. I mean, this conflict here forged people like Hickok in them. And so I've been fascinated with Missouri and the border wars and the history here forever.
All you got to do is get here, man. You got places
to stay. We'll do it. We'll pick this up again.
We won't say goodbye. We'll say see you later.
Right on, man. Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks for coming, Hal.